Good morning and welcome back to the Roundtable. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. 9:13 is the time. Time to begin this morning's panel discussion on topics in the news. Joining us today, WAMC's Alan Shartok, University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo, and associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain. Good morning, all.
Hey.
Hello.
Good morning.
All right. Everyone's fairly enthusiastic this morning. If you want to join in the conversation, feel free to drop us an email, roundtable@wamc.org, or you can comment on our webpage or Facebook page or tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. Love to hear from you. And if something good comes in, Alan will be sure to read it later on in the program. We'll start the show with a bit of forward promotion for a part of the program in the 11 o'clock hour, where we talk to Judy Foreman, who has a book, A Nation in Pain. And the book offers a researched account of the chronic pain crisis from neurobiology to public policy. And it dovetails very nicely with an NPR piece, an extensive piece that was on this morning during Morning Edition, on this new pain pill, which the FDA has approved. It's due to hit the streets in March. And doctors, some doctors, not all that jazzed about the idea. I read here from CNN, new pain pills approval, genuinely frightening. A potent little painkiller is causing a big stir. A coalition of more than 40 healthcare, consumer, and education treatment groups is urging the Food and Drug Administration to revoke approval of the prescription drug Zohydro. The hydrocodone-based drug is the latest in a long line of painkillers called opioid analgesics. The FDA approved the medication last fall to treat chronic pain, and it's set to become available in March. Now, here's a quote. In the midst of a severe drug epidemic fueled by overprescribing of opioids, the very last thing the country needs is a new dangerous high-dose opioid, the coalition wrote. There's a coalition of more than 40 healthcare, consumer, and addiction treatment groups saying, hey, keep this off the streets. Apparently, according to what NPR was reporting this morning, just two of these pills could cause an overdose in an adult. One could kill a child. Is this too much? We'll start with...
And two could kill an adult, right? Is that the idea?
Well, an overdose anyway. Yeah. So I'll throw it out to the panel. Alan, you first. What do you think? Too much?
Oh, no, I'm really against this. I think we have... You know, I've had a couple of operations, and they've always offered me OxyContin, and I've never used one, and I'm not going to use one because I find the reports that we've read on this stuff has been, you know, really kind of sad and scary. And then what happens is once we get these things onto the market, then somehow they get into the underground and people start selling them and overdosing on them, and the kids get a hold of them and other people get a hold of them, and it isn't good. So,
but what about someone who has chronic pain, Rosemary?
I disagree with you on this, Alan. I think that drugs should be available to the people who use them. Yes, OxyContin and other drugs like this one have huge, horrible deficits to people who take them who do not need them. But when taken by people who do need them, they are remarkable. They need to take the drugs. And we have a system so porous that we can't keep them out of the hands of children.
That's right. Yeah.
So the people who are suffering need to suffer because we can't get it right. It's crazy.
I'll get mail on this.
One of the letters will say that as a man, you've never experienced childbirth.
Well, yeah. you don't take this stuff for childbirth. Okay. We're stronger than you all.
No,
however, you do need it for things like I have a similar back injury to Alan, and there are times when I would have loved to have had a pill like this.
Well, you know, there's always, and here's where I get into real trouble. There's always those people who think they need stronger and stronger drugs who really don't, and who, you know, we all carry burdens around with us. We all have anxiety. We all have, you know, different kinds of things that spook us. But the fact of the matter is that I think it's an over-drug society. I've said it.
You're right. It is an over-drug society. But there are different thresholds of pain that different people have. And some people have a much a lower threshold, and some people have a much higher threshold. And if you don't relieve pain, your body can't relax and heal. So after major surgery, you need these kinds of drugs in order to get well.
To recover.
To sleep, to get well, to not be in pain. If you miss your meds when you're recovering from major surgery, anybody who's been through it will tell you this, you risk you know, becoming so stressed and so pained that your body can't heal, and then it becomes a downhill spiral.
For years in this country, we've made dying people suffer needlessly because we wanted to keep drugs away, usually morphine drugs. That's changing. The idea is people should be comfortable when they're healing. And this goes along with that. If you're in chronic pain like this, there should be something available to you to ease your suffering.
Nevertheless, attorneys general from 29 states have said, hey, listen, FDA, stop this right now before it hits the streets.
It is fascinating because the FDA's own panel had recommended against it, and the board of directors or whatever it is overrode that recommendation and approved this drug. But, you know, the deeper part of the story is that this particular drug, while it is going to be very valuable to a very small subset of people who have extraordinary chronic pain from multiple illnesses at the same time, it really isn't going to be necessary for people who have access to OxyContin and all these other drugs that we're debating about. But the way that the drug industry works, unless it's made widely available, they'll make no money.
You have hit the nail on the head, and this is brought about later in the article in CNN.
That's why they're called drug dealers.
Well, they're not. They're pharmaceutical manufacturers. The problem is it costs a lot of money bringing a drug through the clinical trials and then bringing it to market, said Anderson, whose first name eludes me.
Probably Andy Anderson.
Past president of the Washington chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. You have to anticipate the drug company being able to market and get its money back. Now, the FDA is trying to shift hydrocodone-containing drugs from Schedule 3 to Schedule 2.
Correct.
And Schedule 2, that's pending approval
but
by the
DEA. That just brings the street value of the drugs up higher. The more difficult you make it to get it, the higher it's going to cost some person who wants to buy it on the street.
Someone has to advocate for people in pain who need this drug.
You know, I agree with you.
And we're arguing our drug companies want to make money and our police and attorney generals can't really keep them off the streets. Let's talk about that for a while.
Yeah.
And instead now we're going to make them suffer. It's just wrong.
Well, and then there's another facet to this also. When we were reading the story about the Kennedy woman down in on trial, right?
In Westchester County.
Yeah, right.
Carrie Kennedy.
Ambien. And they always mention how many prescriptions for Ambien are filled out every day or every week. We're talking about millions in this country. So, you know, we do become, I'm sorry to say this, Rosemary, I hate to disagree with you, especially when I'm going to get mail, but I understand your empathy. I think
in extraordinary pain who are dying?
No,
should they be denied access to these
drugs? No, they should
drugs?
Get it, but somehow we have to figure this balance out.
Right.
So that we give it to the people who need it, and we keep it out of the hands of the people who don't need it.
Who could disagree with that?
Well, then why are you people giving me so much garbage?
All right, well, that's a fine spot to take a break. Mr. Hopper, let's take a break. The email address here, if you want to complain about Alan, roundtable@wamc.org. roundtable@wamc.org. Back in a flash.
Support for WAMC comes from Joyelle's Jewelers, Del Mar, New York. Specializing in custom jewelry and repair, laser welding, designer jewelry, and gifts, joyellsjewelers.com. Godfrey Financial Associates, Latham, New York. Providing retirement planning and wealth management services for baby boomers and beyond. Independent, woman-owned, established 1995, godfreyfinancial.com. And Bard Graduate Programs in Sustainability. Offering Master of Science degrees in Environmental Policy, Climate Science and Policy, and an MBA in Sustainability. Open house Saturday, March 8th at Bard College, bard.edu/CEP.
All right. Back we are with the roundtable. 9:22 is the time. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. Alan Shartok is here. Rosemary Armeo and Mike Spain. And your emails, if you wish, at roundtable@wamc.org. A couple of paragraphs are fine. Six or seven tend to be a bit much. So we go to another issue facing the FDA. And this is from the New York Times, yesterday's New York Times. The Food and Drug Administration is weighing a fertility procedure that involves combining the genetic material of three people to make a baby free of certain defects, a therapy that certain critics say is an ethical minefield and could lead to the creation of designer babies. The procedure in question involves mitochondria, That's the power producer in the cells that convert energy into a form that cells can use. Mitochondria with defects that could be passed to a fetus are replaced with healthy mitochondria from another woman. This is done either before or after an egg is fertilized. And right now it's been under trial. I think it's actually has been used 10 or 15 years ago, and they stopped it. It's been under trial with gorillas. What do you think, panel? Are we going too far?
Nice idea. Brings a lot of hope to people who want healthy children. Let's keep studying it.
Well, you know, I think...
Let the gorillas keep coming out, right?
Yeah. No, your point is well taken. Look, why do we develop all the medicines we've been talking about to help people? Why do we give people statins? I take a statin. Why? Because it's been proven, at least in quotes, to make us more heart healthy. People are living longer. So now you get another medicine or a procedure. They're equidistant. The question is, will they work? Will they harm? So I hate to say it, but I think I agree with Rosemary that we got to keep...
Why would you hate to say that?
Because I don't like it when I agree with her.
It's more interesting when we spar.
Yeah. But yes, I think you got to make sure you're getting it right.
Right.
And then, after a million people take it, you'll find out you got it wrong.
Well, here's the thing. The FDA is meeting today. They met yesterday as well. And they're not really addressing the ethics. They're addressing the procedures and the science involved. And geneticists, some say, look, there's a step missing here, and it is, in fact, research.
Well, they're connected, and Alan is talking about mistakes. If you make a mistake in a test like this, you end up with a defective baby, okay? Yeah. What do you do with it? Kill it because it's a lab accident? Yeah. The procedures are intimately connected with the ethics in this.
We saw with stem cells that the ethics kind of thing gets interwoven into the debate. Then inevitably it turned out that we could get stem cells from other places other than, you know, the way that we were doing it. And that ended that debate. You don't hear about it anymore. But it was interesting to me that politicians who you would normally expect to be on the other side of the debate, who were conservative or who were anti-abortion, were lining up, in some cases, to support it. And you know why? Because either their father had Parkinson's disease or they had Parkinson's disease or something that this thing offered some hope with. You're not going to stop it.
Well, the idea here, though, is that somebody is trying to achieve the foolproof way of having a perfect baby, you know, and have a baby without any chance for flaws.
Yeah.
And you know, that is a noble you know, cause.
One
everybody
fraught
wants
with danger. I mean,
right. I mean,
eugenics.
How far do you go?
Wait a second. Well, you know, let's say somebody is able to give us a remediation for any disease that exists, sickle cell or Tay-Sachs among Jewish population, other thing. Are you telling me that because you're afraid of eugenics, you don't want them to do that?
Yeah, exactly. The idea of what science might accomplish, stopping you from doing or finding out what it can do right now, is just so reactionary and silly, because under extreme conditions, the bad guys will use the science anyway. We saw that under Nazi Germany.
Yeah. All right. The email address here, and I'm sure you will want to weigh in on this, is roundtable@wamc.org. roundtable@wamc.org. And I'll tell you what, let's shift gears here, and we'll start this, and I think we'll have to pick this up after the news, but let's set it up now. This is from Azzi Pabara and Jimmy Vilcon.
Yep.
And this is a...
He used to work for the Times Union.
This is quite something. Big story, big disclosure. The Observer published a big critical front page profile of Eric Schneiderman, Attorney General. But the main event turned out to be an explanatory editor's note that accompanies the piece. The note begins, "As disclosed in the story, Jared Kushner is the publisher of the New York Observer. His wife is Ivanka Trump, and his father-in-law is Donald Trump. Given that family relationship, the Observer took great care to ensure fair, unbiased journalism throughout the reporting and editing of the story."
That's what they say.
But there's much more to the story.
There is, Ray.
Tell us more. Tell us about it.
Well, I don't have much to say except that the guy who was writing it quit in protest because he said he was being forced to make it into a negative story. He felt he was being forced to make it into a negative story, so he quit, which is what you would hope and expect, that, you know, a working guy or woman who needs a paycheck would have the ethical, you know, backbone to do. You guys are journalists. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. If you were being required to write a story a certain way, that would be unethical. And I can see why a person who has high character would leave a job rather than, you know, twist a story to be unfactual or to take a necessary turn on it.
Is the story unfactual?
Well, I have to confess, I have not read the New York Observer story.
You can read it in the news.
Well, we've been looking at it. You can see right away that the graphic on it is taken from the movie Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't even have to read it to know that our Attorney General is being cast as something evil and, amoral.
Hey, yeah. I've had it done to me.
Yeah.
I've had it done to me. I mean, I know it can happen, and not everybody has the moral fortitude to turn around and say, I'm not going to do this.
I'll tell you what, let's have our panel take a look at this. Now, remember, the article may be fine, but if it's presented with a Clockwork Orange picture and other things that may catch the reader's eye that cast an impression immediately, and I think I see this a lot with headlines, especially in the tabloids.
Sure.
The articles might be okay. The headlines, maybe not. Is that going over the line? We will talk about this with our panel coming up, and we'd love to hear from you. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We will take a break for news. You're listening to The Roundtable. Welcome back to The Roundtable on this Wednesday morning. 9:36 is the time. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. Alan Shartok is here. Rosemary Armeo and the TU's Mike Spain. And we love hearing from you. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Alan especially loves to hear from you when you agree with him. And Alan, apparently some people actually agree with you today.
Well, not everybody agrees with me.
No.
And nor should they.
No.
But, for example, Rosemary doesn't agree with me.
Right.
But, okay.
Nor do I. And
okay.
I don't even know what I disagree with you on.
Well, I know. Maybe.
Fine.
Okay. So anyway, Angelica writes, it's the very first time I'm responding to a subject of your discussions, but this morning I feel so moved because I wonder why people couldn't agree to allow the newly highly potent opiate drug only approved as a controlled substance for patients who really need it. The pharmaceutical company may get their money's worth by corresponding higher cost of the drug on the market. Caris est quod raris est?
I'm sorry?
Whatever that means.
What?
It's Latin. Just wondering, as an old pharmacist in another life, curious to hear more on the subject. Thank you for your thought-provoking program. That's good. Okay. And then there is Martha.
Thought-provoking. That's very nice.
Martha, who writes, a lot of people say that.
Yeah,
as opposed
nice.
To nausea-provoking, yeah. Which is, we get that sometimes.
Not so nice.
Well, yeah.
They have a drug for that, right?
So Martha, just wondering, how would this impact DNA testing in the field of forensics if the DNA of more than two, oh, that's the other thing.
Okay.
If the DNA of more than two people are involved, might this complicate or could this be overcome? Just interesting question to me, Martha.
That is an interesting question.
Do we even talk about it, though?
Okay.
Martha,
no.
Hang on. We're getting to that.
She's on another program already.
Ah.
Good job,
okay.
Martha.
Okay, and Simon says, you're talking about expanding the drug war. I can't remember when I've heard more horrifically bad idea. Simon from Turner's Falls. And then.
So, no, wait a minute. Simon says,
I knew you were going to do that.
Simon says that he is not in favor of regulating this. I can't.
No,
quite,
no, I didn't
I
get
understand.
That. That's not what I got out of it. You're talking about expanding the drug war. I think making more of these drugs available is what I'm taking away from this. I can't remember when you've heard more horrifically bad idea. Simon from Turner's Falls. So I think what he's saying is if you put this out, it expands the drug war. But next time he'll be a
well, yeah, I mean, we do like brief emails, but I think that might have been, we could have used another
not
paragraph.
Not to me.
There.
I thought it was an excellent
okay.
Okay. Julius, our regular correspondent, this country lives on pills. A relatively small number of people are in the intractable pain category. Too small a market for the drug company's profit. Perhaps we need
Pure
a new
attempts.
Model. Perhaps we need a new model for these dangerous drugs, subsidized production for the relatively limited market of truly needy individuals.
Well, that part's all right. But
it makes sense.
But the Puritan idea that you have to tough through pain, that's crazy. Take the drugs when you need it. Stop when you're done.
Easier
you're
said than done. Okay, Greg.
Millions do it.
And millions abuse it. On your one of your commentators said, will be beneficial for a small subset of people, although billions of pills will be distributed, and the drug makers next year goal will be to distribute tens of billions more. Profits, says Greg. Okay.
Well, I think that's the concern, that eventually the very small subset will grow.
I think Julius had a great idea, and that is come up with a way to service the very small. I mean, it's the whole issue of orphan drugs that can be manufactured to service a very, very needy, extremely needy subset, very tiny subset of the society. But there's no profit motive there, so this group goes without a remedy to their medical situation. And this is really all he's saying is there needs to be another model where the government would step in and help get these drugs developed for the people who need them the most without having to mass manufacture them and create this situation where you have to have a drug war because it gets in the hands of the wrong people.
It'll always get in the hands of the wrong people because, you know, while there are many, many wonderful doctors who are very strict about this, there are some who are Dr. Feelgoods, we all know that, and who will prescribe drugs because they can and because it brings in patients.
Right, and it's very easy to do. Yeah, and you're right. I mean, we are, you know, we were talking during the break, our opinion, collective opinion in this room is that there should be a way for the people who need it to get the drugs they need, and there should be a way to keep
we live in a civilized society.
We should have a way to prevent these drugs from getting out on the street.
The sooner as you make something illegal, boy, that brings up the price.
Okay. Is that it on the email, sir?
all that I saw... Yes.
All right.
I think so. Yeah.
So let's go back to the story we started just before the news, and I'll recap it by Jimmy Vielkind and others. The Observer published a big, critical front-page profile of Eric Schneiderman. However, the big story here is there was an editor's note that accompanied the piece saying, hey, Jared Kushner is the publisher of the New York Observer. His wife is Ivanka Trump. His father-in-law is Donald Trump. Given that family relationship, we took great pains, the Observer, that is, to ensure fair, unbiased journalism throughout the reporting and editing of the story. Rosemary Armeo and Mike Spain have had a chance to read a good portion of this article. And, well, what do you think?
It's 11 pages long. It's very long. That's printed out on a sheet of 8x10 paper.
Thank you.
It does not meet my test. It's filled, for example, with negative quotes about the Attorney General.
Unattributed.
Yeah. No one said it. It has been said that.
What do they think they are? The New York Post?
Yeah, and it gives a lot of space to Trump himself. We see way too much from the press anyway, but he's defending himself in here and has free rein in a very large article to do that. The biggest allegation, the main idea of it seems to be that the Attorney General is political. It's an elected position. He's of the dominant party in the state. That doesn't seem a terrible allegation to me.
When is it appropriate in print journalism to use that? You know, it has been said that.
Never.
Never. Not
Never.
Even something innocuous.
The rule is you use... Oh, innocuous is one thing. My complaint here is he's saying really bad things about the Attorney
General.
He's
reporting rumors, essentially.
He's reporting rumors. You can use unnamed sources in certain circumstances and ought to. Definitely, I'm in favor of that. But not in disparaging someone. If you want to rake them over the coals, you get somebody to
say
it on the record.
Use the facts to rake them over the coals. I mean, there are some facts. He did go after Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Which has a connection to this publication. It's clear that the point of view of this article is that was inappropriate because the issue, this Trump University, which was a leadership management training program that Trump lent his name to, was not really a university, and then they changed it to something that didn't have the word university in it, and then it closed. And it was after the fact that Attorney General Schneiderman went after it, according to this article, and they said that he had no business doing that. It was past, you know, it was over and all that. But, you know, if someone committed a crime or broke a rule,
I think you're still responsible,
you know. Yeah. But the pejorative way in which it's written isn't portrayed as journalism. It's portrayed as sort of an opinion piece.
All right. So who takes the blame? If in fact what you both state, is that this is basically a hatchet job, who takes the blame? Does it go all the way up to the publisher?
Yes.
It does.
Yeah.
And
so you're right. Ultimately, the publisher always takes the blame, but he's the one who's related to Donald Trump. He's the one who had the benefit from it.
Hey, buy yourself a newspaper. Have fun.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why a lot of billionaires buy newspapers. It's It's fun.
Oligarchs do it all over Europe. Yeah, for just this. It's, you know, it's really kind of interesting if they had written it as an op-ed piece or as an you know, an editorial and an opinion piece, that might have been just fine. And instead, it has this whole little note that you brought up about went to pains to make sure it was biased.
What if this very article were like in the New Yorker or New York Magazine? It wasn't in a publication owned by Donald Trump, but it was basically was the same. It was a screed against Eric Schneiderman, calling him a political animal who's using his office to promote himself politically. Wow. I've never heard of that before. But what if that were the case and it was not in a publication where Donald Trump was the father-in-law of the publisher and maybe the bankroller of the publication?
I think the Attorney General would still have a case that it is indeed a hatchet job. This is not done fairly. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's lots of hatchet jobs.
But don't you guys think that in the end, Donald Trump gets it in the neck again? In other words, by doing this and are talking about it.
Well, we don't know that he did anything. We don't know that Trump had anything to do with this article.
Well, I say by doing this, I didn't mean Trump doing this. The newspaper doing this with these close ties to, thank you for that, Ray. Good save. Once again, he looks like a bully and a blowhard.
Well, you know, but we're talking about him. Someday I'm going to write this blog. Why is Trump always in the news?
Well, it's
why
the hair,
do we
obviously.
Do this? It's the hair.
Well, yeah. Because he projects himself into it. That's why. I mean,
yeah, but
know.
We fall for it. Really.
I mean, why is Kim Kardashian in the news?
No, that's different.
That's a different reason.
That's way different.
All I'm saying is celebrities tend to go where there's, I mean, you know, inject themselves into high-profile situations.
We're knocking the drug companies for wanting profits. We want clicks. We want people to click on our stories and say, yes, I read it. And that's why Trump is doing it.
Wouldn't it be appropriate for journalists to follow Donald Trump?
No, but that's why we're talking about it today, I think, is the journalistic aspect of the whole thing. In other words, is this proper? You're right about Trump. But as a caricature in my mind, it is sinful to see this kind of thing happening. And anybody who's ever had it done to them in their lives,
you've had it done to you.
I have, and you know, it was a long time ago, and I don't like to bring up certain newspapers where people are sitting in the room. So, it was painful. And, you know, we dealt with it. It went nowhere. But it was onerous. And I'll bet there are a lot of people out there. I mean, I ran to a group one time, and I said, if anybody's had trouble with the press, please raise your hand. And it was a service organization. Everybody in the room raised their hand. So, you know,
more easy targets.
Well, and sometimes appropriate targets.
I don't think this sort of thing is as usual as you're trying to make it sound. Indeed, it was an article. That's how we started. It was an article about the article.
Yep.
Because it is an unusual and bad thing. Mm. We eat our young. When we do make mistakes like this, we call ourselves out on it, as the New York Times did, for example, with the Jason Blair plagiarism. When somebody else does it, you'll see somebody else in the press writing about it, as happened with this Schneiderman article. It's not that bad.
But we have a disagreement here.
How unusual.
Let the record show, the first time ever.
The press is extraordinarily disrespected in the United States. It's right down at the bottom. Along with the congressmen and
the media,
other
the
people.
Institution,
and you can say, Rosemary, well, people don't know what they're talking about, but maybe they do.
I would not say that.
Yeah,
I have nothing to add to that.
Wow.
I don't know what to say. I know that we have a very bad reputation, but
talk
I think
about
we're,
sucking the air out of the room.
Where is the silence?
Well, let's get back to the issue of the Attorney General office. I mean, hasn't virtually every Attorney General used their office to promote their future? I mean,
Elliot Spitzer.
You know, Bobby.
This article says he's
Abrams,
worse than
Robert
those
Abrams
two.
Before them. You know, way back. I mean, it is
Martha Coakley.
Right. It's a jumping point to higher office, and I think Elliot Spitzer really developed the model for using it to gain very high.
But he
profile.
Did good.
He went after the bad guys on Wall Street, and that was how he achieved his fame, and that's how he got elected with what was the plurality when he ran? Yeah, it was like
largest in history.
You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC. 9:49 is the time. We're joined by Rosemary Armeo, Alan Shartok, and the Times Union's Mike Spain. And Mike, what's new in your paper today?
Well, you know, oil train seems to be the story that just keeps on coming. Yesterday in Ulster County, in the town of Ulster, there was a derailment of a empty crude oil train that was en route from, I think, Baltimore to Chicago, but coming through upstate New York. And it illustrates, nothing happened, there wasn't an explosion or anything, but it illustrates the fear that people have, because there have been in the last year some serious accidents involving trains transporting crude oil across the country or in Canada. The most notable was in Quebec last year, where 47 people died after a horrific explosion of an oil train that had rolled down a hill into a community and just caused this great fire. But there was no explosion this time. But again, there's been three others in New York State, accidents involving crude oil that's coming into the state and passing through the state to go out. What's happened is, without a clear passageway through perhaps the a pipeline from Canada to the Gulf, there's still a demand for crude oil coming out of the Midwest and out of Canada, and it's coming on trains. And one of the issues that has come up is that there are certain train cars, tankers, that are not up to standards, that are prone to rupturing when there's been a derailment. Derailments happen. It's a fact of life. And there's people calling for those derailment or for those types of tanks to be removed more quickly. In fact, Senator Chuck Schumer is pushing for a plan that would require that all of these substandard tankers be replaced with more safer, more modern tankers by July, and others are joining that. Meanwhile, people in Albany, there was a hearing last night. The city held a hearing and heard from neighbors who were objecting to the trains coming close to public housing projects, coming right through neighborhoods on their way to the Port of Albany. There's people worried about when they go onto the tankers from the Port of Albany onto these tankers that go down the Hudson River. There was an accident where there was not a spill, thank goodness, a couple of years ago, but it was a tanker taking oil from Albany to take it to a refinery down the East Coast. So this story is not going away. There's a lot of concerns and a lot of angst over it.
All right, in Albany, I'm sorry, Ray, but in Albany, railroad yards, which we have down by the river,
or the Port of Albany.
And which wants to develop even more.
Yes, it's been increased by millions of gallons, right, or millions of tank loads.
Are near public housing.
Okay.
And that's
where they've been. I mean, to be fair, the volume may have increased, but this has been going on for decades and decades.
That fuel has been coming through this route by these public housing projects into the Port of Albany.
We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Roundtable.
Support for WMC comes from the Bardavon, presenting the Met Live in HD, Borodin's Prince Igor, March 1st, the Hudson Valley Philharmonic Beethoven's 5th, March 8th, and Ballet Hispanico, March 15th, bardavon.org. Beacon Institute for Rivers and Estuaries of Clarkson University, accepting applications for a fall hybrid online and in-person Clarkson Master of Science in Engineering Management for working professionals in Beacon, BIRE.org. And A New Leaf Used Books, Pine Plains, New York, an independent bookstore with 7 rooms of books, fiction, poetry, history, gardening, cookbooks, and more, open daily, 12 noon to 5 p.m. A New Leaf Used Books on Facebook.
Welcome back to The Roundtable on WAMC. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue with Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, and Alan Shartok. And we're talking a bit about the transport of oil via train.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean,
really,
I think the broader issue, I wonder what you guys think of this, is that environmentalists are against the Keystone Pipeline, which would bring crude oil, dirty crude as they call it, out of Canada to the Gulf of Mexico for processing and then distribution everywhere, partly because they say it will hurt the environment. There's chances of spills. It'll come through some environmentally sensitive areas. But the broader issue is it will enable this dirty oil to be processed and get to market. If there isn't a way for the oil to get to market, that means that the other fuel sources that are perhaps not as harmful to the environment would have to be relied on and developed. So by Now that because the Keystone Pipeline isn't in place, there's a greater reliance on rail transport of this oil. And if it could be argued that if you discourage the rail transport of this oil and you somehow limit that, that will have the same impact. It'll force other sources of energy to be sought and used. And instead of using dirty fuel oil, which takes a lot of energy just to process, I mean, they have to heat it up to make it, able to process it. And that takes energy. And then the cleaning process is there. And then it does emit the most hydrocarbons of any of the fuels that are being used, except for coal. And so if you're against if you're pro-environment, theoretically, you might be opposed to this just on theoretical grounds or on philosophical grounds, let's say. And then there's people opposed to it because it's coming through their neighborhood. There's been serious accidents, and it poses a risk to human
to shipping oil on big tankers where they can crash in Alaska and cause years and decades worth of destruction.
Decades,
is it worth it?
Yeah.
Decades worth of destruction, yeah, for the
But is it a worthy reason to oppose these tankers coming through your community because you want to stop the use of oil? Or
of
is it that
is,
you
sure.
want to prevent the
yes.
danger
think,
to your community?
I think it's a pretty good tactic, and it has two good reasons for it. One is to force expenditures and better energy sources, and the other is that, it's environmental racism, that it's the poor who are suffering from this inordinately. If one of these tankers derails full, it isn't going to hurt me. Mm. It's going to hurt people in public housing projects. That's
right
not
right.
Who live right next to the rails. Right.
All right. As we wrap up here, a few minutes left. Alan, some more mail to read.
Dear Roundtable, I'm a retired internist. Why is it that our culture takes such delight in the introduction of another pill? In your discussion, there was no discussion of alternative approaches to managing chronic pain. For example, acupuncture, meditation.
You tried
them all,
right?
I've tried them all too.
Yes.
The Army has begun using these modalities to aggressively deal with the epidemic of narcotic use. I urge caution on the introduction of a new opiate. I'm just not reading the whole thing because it's a little long. Tony, while it is not the Free Press of New York of 1990s, it's not a real newspaper like Newsday. This is about
The Observer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then from Irene, Alan Chartok is mixing up two issues, the need for drugs for genuine medical reasons and the illegal abuse of drugs. Yesterday, I spoke of the phone with a friend who has suffered chronic pain for over 40 years, talks about her pain and how the doctor is now putting her on even greater medication.
Yeah.
I understand that. Okay. And Tony,
good letters today.
Yeah, indeed. Tony. When I understand that its editorial slant does not line up with Letitia James, Bill de Blasio, etc., and recognizes Upper East Side focus, people in New York understand that Trump is a pitch man, not a pal.
Well, smart New Yorkers.
And that's what we got.
All right, very good. And if you would like to join us and throw your 2 cents in, roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. You can also comment on our webpage, wamc.org, and hit the roundtable and you'll find a spot to comment, or our Facebook page, or you can tweet us at @WAMCRoundtable. About 30 seconds left. Panel, anything anybody wants to add? Spain,
just
first.
I'm
looking forward. We'll just look for more coverage and more focus on the issue of oil trains coming through Albany. I think it's a hot issue that's going to be around for a long time.
And I'm watching Ukraine, where journalists are piecing through lots of documents left behind when the administration fell. Mm. And they're out like a bunch of little kids at a camp, spreading out the documents, scanning them and looking
through them. Drying them out with hair dryers.
They're finding amazing.
Piecing them back together.
Yes, exactly. They're finding amazing expenditures by the
And Putin president. Is out there rattling the sword.
Yes, he is.
And here he goes again. And the pro-Russian side already. And there was a great piece. We got nowhere close to it. A great op-ed piece in the New York Times.
Has
the West already lost Ukraine? Maybe that can be a topic.
That's your homework, listeners.
Yeah, check that out. That was in yesterday's New York Times. We are out of time. And thanks so much to Rosemary Armeo, Mike Spain from the Times Union, and Alan Chartok. We hope to hear from you. And I'll tell you what, there's still 2 hours of this show to go. Hang around.